At first, Hadra Dawish had trouble with the prone position on the rifle range. I was always wondering, does my uniform cover me enough? Is there a man walking around behind me? But 5 months later, when she graduated top of her class at the United Arab Emirates Military Academy, Hadra Dawish had learned to empty her mind of everything but the target. She had mastered the M16 rifle, Russian rocket-propelled grenades, multi-purpose machine guns, hand grenades, and 9mm pistols. She knew how to rappel from a hovering helicopter and conduct a night reconnaissance patrol through desert terrain. In 1992, she became the first woman from an Arabian Gulf country to enroll for officer training at the British Military Academy, Sandhurst. No one seemed more surprised by any of this than Hadra herself. She had been born in 1967 into one of the most conservative Muslim societies. In those days, most women of the Emirates lived in strict seclusion. Outside the family, they wore the long black abaya and a cloth veil over their faces. Even at home, many women wore the burqa, a black and gold canvas or leather mask that conceals everything but the eyes. Sending a daughter to an all-girls school was considered a risky step. Less than a decade ago, conservative families wouldn't allow their sons to marry any girl who had been seen by anyone, man or woman, outside the family circle. Hadra's family had been progressive enough to send her to school and to allow her to work as a therapist with handicapped children, a job that didn't involve any contact with men. She went to and from her job, wearing a cloak-like abaya and niqab, or face veil. "I never questioned it," she said. "The truth is, I still prefer to dress this way when I can. It's just that it isn't possible for a soldier." Now she wears desert camouflage fatigues with a jacket cut long and loose to hide the curves of her body. Under her soldier's cap, a tightly wrapped scarf covers her hair. Hadra became a soldier for the same reason most people do. "I love my country," she says. "I don't want to see it destroyed." In 1990, Hadra had watched in horror as Iraq invaded neighboring Kuwait. Kuwait's flimsy forces, mostly staffed by foreign recruits, quickly collapsed. Kuwaiti refugees fled to the Emirates with tales of rape and destruction. The United Arab Emirates is a mirror image of Kuwait, rich, tiny, and tempting to tyrants. In the palace of the Emirates president, Sheikh Zayed, strategists racked their brains to figure a way to boost their own small army of 50,000 men. The Emirates, after all, had less than 500,000 citizens to draw on. It was Zayed's wife, Sheikha Fatima, who argued that the tiny state could no longer afford to waste half its population. Her radical solution: recruit women. Sheikha Fatima wasn't Zayed's first wife, or his only one. The Sheikh, a tribal leader in the days before the Emirates united to form a modern state, had married often, like the Prophet, to cement treaties and further political alliances. Usually the wives would stay with him for a few years before being divorced and sent back to their families with honor and a sizable fortune. But Fatima had won his heart and also his respect and became the official First Lady of the Emirates. She had married the Sheikh as a child bride with little education beyond basic study of the Quran. She had used the resources of the palace to pursue her education, studying English and classical Arabic. In 1973, she started the Abu Dhabi Society for the Awakening of Women, aimed to eradicate illiteracy and train women in trades. Still, by the 1990s, Emirates women were only gingerly arriving in the workforce. Just a handful had started taking jobs that put them in contact with men. One of them was a friend of the Sheikha's, a trailblazer named Hessa Al-Khalidi, the Emirates' first woman civil engineer. With Zayed's approval, the Sheikha delegated Hessa to solve the problems of recruiting the Emirates' first women soldiers and reconciling the religious establishment to their existence. Hessa took a year's leave from her job at the Public Works Department and went straight to the Islamic history books. At issue was the matter of jihad, or holy struggle, to spread the faith and defend the Muslim community. Jihad is obligatory on all Muslims, but can take many forms. In the Western mind, jihad has become synonymous with acts of terrorism carried out by extremist Islamic groups. But teaching the faith or spreading the word through an exemplary life also are forms of jihad. Women's role in jihad was an issue even at the time of the Prophet. In the first years of the faith, when the Muslim community had to fight to establish itself in the face of hostility from existing religious groups, some women clamored to contribute. Victorious soldiers were blessed by God and enriched with a share of the spoils of the defeated enemy. A hadith records this exchange between the Prophet and one of his followers. "I am the delegate of women to you. This jihad was made obligatory on all men. If they win, they are given worldly rewards, and if they are killed, they are alive with their Lord, well provided for. But we Muslim women, we serve them. What do we get for that?" Muhammad replied, "Convey to the women you meet that obedience to their husband and the acknowledgement of their favors is equivalent to that jihad." The Emirates Muslim authorities quoted that hadith in their arguments against recruiting women soldiers, but Hessa al-Khalidi countered with historical evidence showing that women did fight alongside Muhammad and were honored for it. Armed with examples, Hessa gradually wore down opposition to the new women's military academy. "I would ask them, if it wasn't forbidden then, why forbid it now?" Even the conservatives couldn't argue against the example of the Prophet. But one question kept coming up. Who would train the women? The Emirates' only qualified instructors were men, and that was unthinkable. A male officer couldn't supervise unveiled women's physical fitness training or barge into a woman's barracks to enforce discipline. He couldn't touch a woman to adjust her stance with a rifle. The answer was obvious to anyone who had watched the U.S. military descend on nearby Saudi Arabia. There, U.S. Army women were flying troop transports, maintaining missile batteries, trucking munitions to the front lines. The Emirates asked the U.S. Army if it could spare a few of its senior women to run a basic training course. Fort Bragg chose 10 specialists, whose average length of service was 14 years. Their commander, Major Janice Karpinski, was already serving in Saudi Arabia. Before they began work, Hessa arranged for each of the U.S. soldiers to spend 2 days living with an Emirates family so they would at least glimpse the cultural background from which the recruits were coming. As she arrived at the huge house of an Emirates Army officer, Tracy Borum, a military police captain from Nashville, Tennessee, felt nervous. "I worried that they'd see me as a Western woman invading their home and challenging their ways," she said. Instead, she found herself an honored guest. She feasted on camel meat, sweet and sort of greasy, tried on a burqa, a weird feeling like I was trying to hide from somebody, and watched the women perfume themselves by placing incense braziers under their long robes. I was sure they'd set themselves on fire. Meanwhile, Hessa was screening applicants from over 1,200 women who had answered advertisements seeking volunteers. She chose 74 women, ranging in age from 17 to 31, and in education from completion of sixth grade to high college degrees. "At first I tried to screen out women with small children," she said, "but that was impossible. In the Emirates, women still marry quite young and start their families as soon as they can, so almost all the women in the right age group had young children. But because most of them lived in extended families, there were plenty of mothers and aunts in most households willing to provide childcare." Hessa found that many of the applicants came from families with a brother or father already in the military. The chosen group included about 7 sets of sisters. At first, as the United States trainers divided the recruits into 3 platoons, they considered splitting up the sisters, but decided against it when they saw that the women seemed to work better with a sister's support. None of the women had been physically active. Most had never spent a night away from home. Tracy Borum remembers their extreme shyness. Raised from childhood with the Quranic injunction to lower their gaze and be modest, the women now found themselves hollered at to square their shoulders and stare their officers in the eye. "At first I had to go around lifting their chins to get them to look at me," Tracy recalls. The Americans had to adjust some aspects of their training. The drill sergeants yelling at them to get in formation or to go in the barracks were just about scaring these poor women to death, recalls Janice Karpinski. American recruits expect that. They've seen all the movies. The drill sergeants learned that lavishly praising recruits who got it right worked better than abusing those who got it wrong. The women had been raised to please, Tracy Borum discovered. So we tried to become the people they wanted to please. Other modifications included arranging the drill schedule to include prayer times and rescheduling heavy physical training for nighttime during the month of Ramadan after the women had broken their day-long fast. Janice Karpinski and a few of the instructors fasted all day along with their troops. I wanted to show solidarity with them, but I also wanted to know exactly what their physical condition was. If one of them said she couldn't make it through a 4-mile run, I'd say, "You can, because we can, and we were fasting too." Except for Ramadan, the day started with the prayer call at about 5:30 each morning. After prayers, recruits in black sweatsuits lined up for physical training. "We do the PT before any of the male administrators show up," said Tracy. That way, the recruits could work out with their hair uncovered, although they usually kept their scarves tied around their waist just in case. Only 15 women dropped out of the course. Some couldn't cope with the presence of a few male administrators in the military school. Others missed their families or their maids. Those who stayed thrived. At first, the American trainers had revised their fitness targets downward to accommodate women who'd never had to walk to the grocery store, much less complete a forced march. But within weeks, the targets had been raised again, as the women easily mastered 100 push-ups a day. One recruit shed 44 pounds during the 5-month training. As the course wound towards its end in May 1991, "We saw this metamorphosis take place," says Janice Karpinski. "In the last 30 days, I never saw these women but that their shoulders were squared, their heads tall. When Hadra Dawish took leave to visit her family, they were shocked at the changes in her. They told me I'd changed too many things, from the way I walk to the way I act with them," she said. "Some they liked, some no." Hadra had found her women friends hardest to convince. Sitting in their gilded salons with foreign maids passing trays of sweet pastries, they shuddered at Hadra's tales of digging foxholes and standing guard all night in desert camps. They kept saying to me, "You have to come out. You've made a terrible choice." But I knew I'd made the right decision. Meanwhile, some senior officers in the Emirates Army found it hard to credit the fine results the women recruits were achieving. Lieutenant Colonel Mohammed Nasser, commander of the academy, had admitted from the beginning that he felt lukewarm about the whole idea of women warriors. "If we had a bigger population, I'd rather see women stay at home," he said. But slowly, he had to revise his view of their capabilities. At first, he refused to believe the women's shooting scores. "When I see the results of 38 out of 40, I have to be surprised," he said. The women, after all, had grown up in an atmosphere in which girls never even played at aiming a toy gun. The lieutenant colonel wondered if the high scores reflected a defect in the newly built shooting range at the women's academy. To find out, he commandeered the men's academy shooting range and ordered the women to redo the test. There, he watched in growing astonishment as bullet after bullet slammed home, right smack in the center of the target. Before I went to the Middle East, I'd always found myself on the dovish side of every argument. Despite glaring evidence to the contrary, Golda Meir, Margaret Thatcher, I believed that a world with more women in positions of power would be a more peaceful place. So it seemed odd, and a little sad, that of all the rights a woman might aspire to, the one that Hadra and her friends had won was the right to kill and be killed. And yet, it was impossible not to celebrate the strength the Emirates women had discovered in themselves, the skills they'd mastered, and the confidence that seemed to shine from every face I encountered on the base.